Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, or our monthly housing update. Today's episode is actually going to be a bit of a yearly outlook. So I've been doing my forecast and predictions videos for gold, silver, crypto, and today I've got our friend Martin from Digital Finance Analytics back, and we are going to talk all about, I guess, the Australian economy, global economy, interest rates, the bond market, property market. That's what everyone wants to know about, Martin. So first of all, how have you been? How was your break?
It was good. It was pretty short, but DFA got over 50,000 subscribers for the first time on our YouTube channel, which is quite a big event. That's taken 2 years from scratch. So, you know, I'm pretty
fantastic.
Chuffed with that.
I think I probably would have been about the same ballpark, I think, Martin. So about, that two-year mark. So. Well done. And it ebbs and flows, like I was saying to you before. It's so funny, isn't it, when there's like topics that are trending and these different channels. And some of the crypto channels in America, some of these guys have got like 100,000 subs in a month. It's just crazy at the moment.
It is, but, absolutely. What's really interesting is the posts that actually turn people off. It's quite interesting who unsubscribes for what reasons. And interestingly, on my channel, the crypto conversations do turn some people off, which is interesting.
Mm. Yeah, no, I kind of look through your comments sometimes, especially when you post a crypto video, just to see what the vibe's like. And there's a couple of other channels out there that one of them was bashing crypto, and I made him a bet that Bitcoin and Ethereum would pass all-time highs. And I've been waiting 3 years, and I haven't gone over to his channel yet and said, I told you so. So he's always bashing them. But look, that's probably not a bad place to start in terms of like social media. And just, you know, today as we're recording, Wall Street Bets is just, you know, GameStop's gone from $3 to $400. AMC's their next stock. Then there's Nokia they're talking about. Silver, they want to try and help the silver market. I mean, this is just absolute insanity. And today they've even jumped on Dogecoin. I'm not sure if you know, Martin. It's like just a bit of a meme coin, a bit of a joke coin in the crypto world. And that's gone up 300% today. So I think it shows a lot of things, but it shows, firstly, how much money is out there. There's just flooded the system, all central banks. But the democratization of finance, I think it's one thing when they have these no-fee trading apps and they say, oh, we want to get everyone involved. But then, you know, oh, we're shutting it down because the hedge funds are short. There's just so many ways where they never lose. It's, you know, crony capitalism. And that's pretty frustrating to see. And I think that anger just builds up more momentum and people are going to want to do something about it.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that if anybody had any doubt that capitalism is controlled by a few, then you saw it in spades over the last 24 hours, you know, when effectively you could trade on one side but not the other side. And, of course, the hedge funds were protecting their own backs whilst individual investors essentially couldn't do what they wanted to do. But I have to tell you, Alex, that I have had the view for some time that pretty much all of the financial markets are rigged to an extent. You can look at gold, you can look at silver, frankly, you can even look at some of the crypto markets, and you can absolutely look at the interest rate and stock markets. For example, on the stock markets, if you are an individual stock trader and you're trying to trade, you won't see the dark pools. You won't be able to actually participate in the auctions, which means that you don't get the best possible prices when you trade stocks. And so pretty much wherever you look, what you realize is that this whole thing is tilted against individuals. Another example, you know, high frequency trading. You know, there are people with massive computers and very high level connectivity to get close to the exchanges to get that microsecond advantage. So people need to understand, I think, that the markets are not square, they're not straightforward. And as an individual, whether you're buying or selling, you may well be at a more of a disadvantage than you think.
Yeah, I've done episodes on that as well, Martin. It's fascinating for people that haven't seen Flash Boys or read the book about high-frequency trading. Yeah. Something that other people might not know. So for those that aren't familiar, Wall Street Bets is like a Reddit, like a website, chat room sort of group, and it's grown. And now there's thousands and thousands of these traders, and it's got to the point where they're buying options, and that forces the brokers to buy to hedge their positions, and it kind of creates this momentum where they're moving these stocks. They've got so big now that they're actually moving stocks, which is crazy to think about. But the other thing is that a lot of these Robinhood and the other apps, they make their profits from selling the data to third parties so that the hedge funds can front run these consumers. Yep. And that's all well and good for the high frequency stuff and a few other reasons. but now it doesn't really help them with this like momentum style of trading. So it's almost like they've found their weak point. And then this morning we heard that they're shutting down these things and saying you can't trade them, but they were also closing clients' positions. So you're getting an email saying, hey, yeah, you might have put on this position and you might have made all this money, but we've actually closed that for you. Bad luck. And actually, in the crypto world, there's a few of these exchanges that are starting to list these stocks or synthetic versions of them. So more and more reasons where people are saying, oh, I kind of understand this crypto thing now. It's about, you know, cutting out all this censorship and suppression and deplatforming.
Yes, and it's just worth reflecting on something else, and that is that of all the US dollars ever created, more than 20% have been created in the last year. Right, so we've got this huge amount of liquidity floshing around the system, and of course it's partly from central banks, but of course government checks mean that a lot of individuals got some money, and quite a lot of that money has gone into the markets. And interestingly, quite a few people have actually done quite well, because of course the stock markets have performed quite well since March, April time. And so there's a growing sense amongst individuals, oh, this is easy, I can just go and make some money on the markets, until of course we get these sort of roadblocks like we have now. The problem of course is that people don't really understand really how things work and who's controlling it. There are a small number of players who really hold all the cards, and that's of course why the crypto decentralized world is just, you know, it's a light speed different mode of operation, isn't it?
Yeah, completely agree. And it's funny, when you look at the stock market, I think you can even see it in the charts. It's been on pretty low volume this last year or so. And that is just the retail guys as the insiders. You can see in the stats that they're just gradually selling. They're issuing more shares. They're borrowing more money to do buybacks and whatnot. So it's got to this place now where these valuations are crazy, but they're on low volume, and there's not a lot of liquidity there. So if we get that selling and cascading, which we've seen one day of now because the Fed upset the markets, which we might get into next, it's all just very phony and propped up in that sense. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens, because every time in history, this has been when the markets hold the Fed hostage. They sell off sharply, and then the Fed come in and rescue them. So, yeah, any thoughts on what happened the other day and what Jay Powell said,
Mark? Well, yeah, it's interesting, of course, because he basically said, well, look, you know, don't worry about inflation. There's no inflation on site. In fact, I'd be quite happy for a bit of inflation, but we will go on doing what we are doing, and we'll do it as much as for as long as we need to try and get the economy through this. And implicitly saying, you know, don't worry, markets, we've got your back, right? The point, of course, is, and it's the fundamental question, will the central bank strategy of the liquidity creation and everything else really take us to where they want us? Because there's no real evidence around the world of inflation growing. In fact, most of the central bank's operations have tended, I think, to be deflationary, not in terms of the quantity of funds that are created, but obviously low interest rates. And even the local data from the ABS didn't show much in the way of you know, inflationary pressures. And with that 20% of US dollars in the last year, you would have expected inflation would have broken out, right? But it hasn't. What it has done, of course, is flown into particular assets, including stock markets and other asset classes. But this is not in the real economy. This is not good for the real economy. And I guess the other point, just to highlight briefly, is that there's a huge number of people who are using margin leverage to buy into these markets, right? So people are not only leveraged one time, but they're leveraged multiple times, which means that if there is a reversal, and I still think the reversal is quite likely down the track, and probably September this year is my pick, but you know, who knows, that could also amplify the downside. And one of the things that you saw both with the last 24 hours and beyond is, because of the options trading and because of the margin calls and things, any movements, specifically significant volatility, creates huge amounts of amplification. And that's why I think the markets are highly unstable.
Yeah, I completely agree about that. Like the butterfly effect or the ripple, it's just so much leverage in the system. For the first time ever, the last year, we passed the volume of options in rather than actual spot markets. And even the other day, like I knew quite a fair bit about shorting stocks and whatnot. I'd done it myself, but I didn't realize that you could actually borrow more than 100% of the float.
Yep.
So GameStop was actually 130% of those shares had been lent out for from brokers. And again, I don't even know how that is legal. If 100% of the shares are already out and borrowed on issue and people are shorting them, how can JP Morgan or whatever broker it is say, oh, okay, have 36% more? It's not, it's almost not possible to pay that back. Like, I guess you can pay a higher price and whatever, but it's just, I don't think that that's fair. Like, at what point do you say, oh, 1,000% of the shares are borrowed for people to short? It's just nonsense.
Well, of course, the point is that if you actually think about it, you can have derivatives on both sides of the equation, right? So the idea is they'll always close them out, so they never actually need physical delivery. Great example is gold, right? The interesting question is, what's the relationship between the underlying volume of gold and all of the gold contracts that are out there? And depending on how you calculate it, and there are different ways of calculating it, it's either 8 times or 50 times, right? So 8 times or 50 times the underlying, which tells you that people are taking positions in the market with an expectation of being able to take a profit and close out, not looking for physical delivery. Now, if, for example, physical delivery became important, both, you know, in gold or in silver, you would see the gold price and the silver price go through the roof. But we know that those markets are highly manipulated, and we know that most of those will get closed out along the way. And I would argue that if you look at the trend on gold and silver over the last few years, there is huge evidence of a manipulated market.
Yeah, I think silver's even more so, like 200 or 500 to 1, depending on how you count it. Mm. And look, not everyone needs physical delivery, and it's okay to be able to hedge, but when those markets grow far bigger than the underlying, I'm surprised that all the silver miners, for example, haven't got together and said, well, let's not let them determine the price of the commodity that we're producing. Let's hold it back. And I think we're going to start to see that change a little bit. We saw it break down a bit in March, and that was to do with supply chains as well. That's what the Wall Street Bets guys want to do, because the market cap of silver is only $30 billion. You know, that's the size of a crypto. And so if all these guys actually get in there and start buying and causing the momentum and whatnot, I think they can really cause, you know, a huge run up in price there. So very interested to see what happens there. But it's got to the point where it's just so out of touch with reality. They have to keep it suppressed because it just creates this financial black hole. And they're going to try and do this with Bitcoin. Hmm. And I don't think they will be able to, because Bitcoin trades 24/7 in, you know, all every different country around the globe. We've already hit the circuit breakers a few times in the Bitcoin futures markets because it moves so much over the weekend. But I just think that, yeah, once you have a gold and silver market and you trade on the US terms, on their hours, how they like it, it just creates a black hole because you can keep issuing infinite amounts of contracts and people get exposure to the price, but you can put in $1 trillion of buy orders and it doesn't move the value of gold up at all because you're not buying any real gold.
No, that's exactly right. But let's touch on Bitcoin briefly, because, of course, there's been a massive run-up, and, you know, the run-up has been pretty astronomical in the last month or two. And then, of course, it's moved up and down quite a lot recently. And I'm reading, you know, what various people say, and on one side of the equation there is, well, there's nothing in terms of intrinsic underlying value, so its real value could be zero. I'm seeing other people saying, oh, you haven't seen anything yet. There's another significant rise ahead. I find it very hard to know where on that continuum truth lies, but it seems to me that as the major financial markets continue to do what they do, people will turn more and more to the crypto world, which is a different set of logic, but not so controlled.
Yeah, it's definitely hopefully more of a free market, or, you know, more democratized and open to everyone. There's certainly, like you said, manipulation and whales and whatnot, but I think the thing that more and more people are realizing, and today it's Ray Dalio. So it's just, it's got that stamp of approval from people that are very trusted in the investing community. Hmm. But it's a pretty simple concept once people understand money. And more people have understood it this year that, oh my gosh, the US has printed 25% more currency and everyone else has been devalued that amount. And so you've got these companies like MicroStrategy, they're holding a big conference this week and they're teaching everyone else, all these corporations, how do you legally buy Bitcoin and put on your balance sheet if you don't want to be devalued 25% year over year? And if they want to meet their liabilities, the US, they're probably going to have to do 25% again. You know, these deficits are trillions and trillions of dollars. And so it's one thing for all these US companies to do it, but then you've got individual investors, but then you've got all these developing countries whose currency is way worse than the US dollar. So are all those companies and all those individuals going to look for this form of money that they know is the most scarce? And it's a pretty, you know, pretty simple logic if you just frame it like that. And I think more and more people are saying, well, you know, that track record is now 12 years, and it's been through these cycles and booms and busts. And I honestly just think it goes up and down so much because it is heading to such a high market cap to compete with currencies and gold. And during that time, there's people that make a lot of money, and then they take some profits, and then it sells off, and people panic that it's dead, and it just goes through these cycles. So that's kind of the way I view it.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And, you know, I continue to believe that the future is going to be digital, and digital money is going to be part of the future. No doubt about that. I'm not quite sure what shape that will be and whether Bitcoin will be the key actor. But what you can say at the moment is it's a critical part, right? About 70% of all crypto, right? And there are more than 4,000 different coins out there, at least on the last count. And, you know, the total volume of assets sitting in cryptos has gone up and continues to rise. So that is going to be a significant force. On the other side, you've got, of course, central banks and their digital currencies. And we had Yellen came out and, you know, Lagarde came out and said, well, you know, got to be careful with these cryptos. Bitcoin is being used for money laundering, all the criminal activities. You know, we probably need more controls. So you're going to see this tussle between central bank land and decentralized land. And I think this year will be the year in which some of these battles get played out.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been saying the war for control of money between governments that want to issue their own coins, central banks that want to go direct to consumers to try and stoke inflation, and then the banks that actually kind of have the power to create money through lending and loans. You know, JP Morgan wants to create JP coin and whatnot. So, yeah, that is going to be a very interesting battle. And we saw things get kind of nasty between Trump and Jay Powell on Twitter. Is that going to start to happen in the media? We're going to see quotes from, you know, the bankers versus the government versus, you know, China trying to get people to use their digital yuan. You know, the Bank of International Settlements, the big guy, he's out there telling people that, oh, these stable coins, we can only trust central banks to issue them. So, hey, everyone wants that power because they want to watch everything we're doing.
Mm. And I think that the linchpin question for this year is whether the US dollar will use its status as, if you like, the currency of last resort or not, right? And it's fascinating listening to different commentators because there are some saying, no, the US dollar is always going to and will continue to be right there at the center, and the bulk of trade is done in US dollars, and that gives the US quite an advantage. There are other people saying, well, maybe the US dollar is losing its position. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, what is going to replace it? You know, is it going to be, you know, Chinese currency? Is it going to be a digital currency? Is it going to be something else or a basket? And again, I think that's going to be a really interesting debate to watch this year because as some of the operations in the US play out with more stimulus and with more money coming in from government to try and support the economy, it'll be interesting to see whether the US dollar maintains its position or not.
Yeah, I think mathematically, the US economy has become a smaller and smaller fraction of global trade and GDP. But the advantage that they've got has become bigger and bigger, being the world reserve currency. You know, now people requiring trillions and trillions of their currency. So they get to print it all. They get to benefit from the rise in all the financial markets and assets. A lot of the money that other central banks print ends up making its way to the US because that's where the best stock market is and the highest yields were. So everything has kind of been to the advantage of the US while everyone else has suffered, and people are saying enough's enough. The other thing I did want to mention just quickly, Martin, was we've spoken about the currency wars. Are all these different countries, you know, it's kind of in sync. It's like pass the baton, we're doing QE now, we're doing it. But it's kind of all at once at the moment. And Australia went out there and said, you know, 100 billion of QE in 6 months. And that sounds like an enormous number, and it is for us. But compared to everyone else, it was still pretty tame, and the Aussie dollar has been rising. So that, again, a battle, or not a battle, it's almost like the central banks are now saying, well, we're kind of tapped out. We don't want to print trillions and trillions. Our balance sheet's already exploding. Government, you need to spend trillions and trillions. It's kind of up to fiscal policy to pick up the slack now. But the governments around the world are kind of under pressure to not run these huge deficits. And in places like Europe, they're just so constrained, they can't really even do that, individual countries. So that is going to be another big pressure between, hey, you do it, no, you do it. And the people are just sort of left in the middle there.
It is a really astonishing situation. I mean, if you think of the amount of debt we're sitting on here in Australia now, government debt, and, you know, the forward estimates, I think we will be at 1.8 trillion over the next 5 years, right? That's a big number. And of course, interest rates are really, really low. And so the argument is, well, it doesn't cost that much to service that debt. But at the end of the day, that debt ultimately, either you continue to live with it forever or you've got to find a way of skinning it down. And so there will be a debate down the track at some point about how you actually reduce the amount of debt. And in the meantime, the question is, do you put more debt into the system to try and support the economy? And of course, a lot of the flow of funds from the Reserve Bank to the banks is to encourage the banks in Australia to lend more. Very low rates, of course, and we're seeing the credit grow a little bit, although interestingly, net credit isn't growing that fast at the moment. So I would expect to see more initiatives from the Reserve Bank trying to help the banks to lend more. I would expect to see some pressure on governments in terms of how much more they can actually put into the system. And I do expect to see some debates, perhaps more objective debates as well, in terms of how much debt is feasible and how much isn't. But if you look at Europe, I think Europe is a really good case study of where you get to, right? Because they've been at this longer. Negative interest rates in many places in Europe, banks are now being paid by the ECB to lend. Work that on out, right? And in fact, of course, we know in some places they've even now got negative rates on mortgages. So this is a Alice in Wonderland world. But I'm not sure it's sensible. I'm not sure it actually takes us anywhere hopeful. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really impact the real economy, right? And it doesn't actually impact individuals, right? So we're seeing the devaluation of assets. We're seeing essentially the critical confusion out there. And I'm afraid that the quest for financial stability among central banks has become the mantra. And I think they're missing the point.
Yeah, there's probably two things I'd add there, that even in Australia, we've seen the central bank go direct to the state governments and buy their bonds. Yep. But I don't think there's any plan. So it's all well and good to keep buying the bonds off these people, the governments, state governments, and giving them money. But, you know, that's only one part of the problem. There's not a real plan of what's the best way to create, you know, new high-paying jobs in relevant industries and all that. And that's the thing, we haven't upgraded at all. It's just how big a first home owner grant do we need to, you know, get the next wave of people in?
Yeah, so I think the really interesting point here is that if you want a growth strategy for our economy, as I think we do, right, there is a critical path of investment and a critical path of innovation, right? Otherwise, we just continue to repeat the history of the past, which is, oh, well, we'll bring more people in, increase migration. We'll sell more of the minerals offshore, hopefully iron ore, you know, there's still demand for that. And potentially, we'll continue to lend more so that people can buy more houses to blow house prices higher. Now, that's essentially where they are. There is very little, I think, thematic around real innovation. I've been speaking to a few people who are saying, look, there are things we could do. You know, we could invest in, you know, rail, and we could actually do new things to be able to actually create new sets of products and services really grow the economic base of the country, because we've got a very narrow base here. But I don't see any debate on that. It's like the current government just wants to play the last 10 to 15 years again and hope that China's still with us.
Yeah, well, China's another thing that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Again, the differences between corporates that are borrowing all this cheap free money and governments. So governments are still pretty reluctant, you know, even Australia cutting back those programs as soon as they can, whereas RBA saying, hey, be careful, if you cut off these people that really need it, that's just going to be, you know, double fold bad down the track. But that appetite, like we saw, again, MicroStrategy, this company said, well, if money's cheap and you're paying us almost to borrow, well, we're just going to, you know, issue more debt to buy Bitcoin. Now, someone else might buy gold or buy their shares back, whatever it is. But it's just that is right there, that clear example of what causes inequality, because these people are going to keep doing that. And I think regulators are going to have a problem, because if all these companies start saying, well, hey, if you're going to give us free money, we're just going to use it to go buy these other things. We're already starting to see assets and commodities rise in China. You know, this, you know, people say China's hoarding commodities. We don't know if like Russia and China are just printing as much money as they want out of thin air and, you know, using it to buy all these different things. So these are the dynamics in play where people are having to start to question, well, yeah, what is money and what is value when we're all just printing it out of thin air to buy this stuff off each other?
That's right. And of course, a lot of those firms that are buying back shares are effectively zombie firms, right? They're not actually investing in their own businesses. They're not actually being innovative. They're not creating more stuff. What they're doing is just buying back their shares and lifting their share price. And part of that tells you about the metrics of success. So if executives in those firms are measured on share price, then that's what they're going to do. Where is the innovation? Where is the long-term growth strategy? And, you know, around the world, if you read some of the literature, people are suggesting that maybe 30 to 40% of firms should have failed and haven't failed, right? So we've got zombie companies everywhere. And in Australia, we've got a lot of zombie companies too, you know, for the same reasons. We also, of course, in Australia have a lot of small businesses who have been unable to access some of the government support. And now, of course, are being exposed as the JobKeeper, JobSeeker, and all the other programs end at the end of March. And now the bankruptcy laws have come back too. So I think we're going to see some interesting cracks beginning to appear in some of the firms, large and small. And then the question is, to what extent will the government and the central banks allow firms to fail? In other words, capitalism working, or will they continue their strategy of not letting anything fail? Because that's the mode we've been in for some time. So everything is allowed to be supported, and, you know, everybody wants more support. We'll keep the airlines a bit longer, et cetera, et cetera. I guess my question, Alex, is at what point do you allow capitalism to work its, you know, normal, well, capital goes to the most successful rather than the least successful? Or do we just walk away from that and say that's not the rule of the game now? The rule of the game is he who shouts loudest, he who has the biggest political connections, gets the biggest levels of support from government.
Yeah, well, I think indirectly that's already the case, because they can say, oh, we're targeting unemployment and we can't let businesses go down, big business especially, because they employ the most. So that's, you know, again, they're going to always just change and move the goalposts. One thing I think we've got to watch out for this year is the housing market. So there's already articles saying 30% over the next 3 years. And I actually think that that's possible, but it's not going to be a good thing. Again, it's going to be inequality. We're already hearing that it's going to take a long time to get unemployment back to where it was. So that means more people unemployed. That has the knock-on effects for couples as well. So you're going to see the home ownership rate go down. Younger people are just getting priced more and more out of the market as youth unemployment goes up. And the interest rate's so low, and they're telling people, you know, forget that responsible lending. Just the wealthy guys that are coming to the banks are going to get loans. And so they're going to end up owning 20 properties instead of 10. And they end up, you know, just it's not rent seeking, but, you know, in some ways they do have a lot of advantages, and that's not really fair, or it's not good long term for those assets to keep accruing, I guess, up the ladder.
Well, there's 2 points there. The first is, if you look at it statistically speaking, 2/3 of people, households in Australia, have property. They're either mortgaged or they've got it without a mortgage, right? So the government is always going to want to protect home prices, because from the election perspective, if you let prices fall, then the chance of getting re-elected degrades. So that's the first point. And interesting, of course, ScoMo last year, before he was re-elected last time, pretty much made a promise that prices wouldn't fall. The second is that the inequality that's created by this is pretty stark, insofar that there are people with, as you say, multiple properties and continue to do well. They will continue to borrow and get ever more properties, I guess. But other people, not so much. Affordability is getting worse despite interest rates are low. And to give you one example of that, the home builder programs that focused on specifically the construction of new builds, if you look carefully at the recent ABS statistics, they actually came out and said, look, did you know that the price of those home builds went up by more than the home builder grant? Because essentially the builders and developers just lifted the prices. So it's a zero-sum game with all those stimulus packages. It doesn't necessarily mean that you actually create more affordable housing. It's just driving the construction sector a bit harder. So we've got this conundrum. And remember this, on an absolute basis, 40% over long-term value is where property prices are. Now, when I say long-term value, I look at GDP incomes, right? So those ratios are already extreme. That 30% rise you mentioned is basically from an RBA paper that a guy called Chidip wrote a few years ago, which basically said if you cut interest rates by 100 basis points over the long term, prices could go up 30%, right? So it's a correlation directly with cutting rates. Doesn't tell you anything about the level of debt. So I think their model is deeply flawed. But nevertheless, there is a scenario over the next 3 to 5 years where home prices could go higher. I think it's going to be determined partly by what happens with migration. You know, will the borders open? Will people come into Australia? Will they be encouraged by the government? I think it's also a question of what happens to property investors. A lot of property investors are losing their shirts at the moment. Then yields are down, the rents are down. And then the other thing is, what's going to happen to those first-time buyers who committed off the plan and then discovered that they can't get the construction processes underway because they can't get labour and the costs of materials go up? I think we've got a whole bunch of bear traps being laid here, which people aren't fully aware of.
Yeah, I definitely agree that we hear about the builders putting up the prices and then, you know, taxpayers have to pay that eventually. So it's all kind of comes out in the wash. I would say in some places, like we've seen crazy demand down here in Tassie, and we have heard about the people that want to move out, particularly when there was lockdowns. You know, obviously we're seeing that trend globally of moving out of the cities. So yeah, that's all the things that are going to come back, and the RBA will probably end up buying a lot of those commercial mortgage-backed securities. The banks have got record profits in the year that we've had a massive recession, so they're never allowed to lose. But it is very interesting what lays ahead, Martin, and I'm looking forward to our monthly updates. Any final thoughts on all that?
Well, only that I think that it's worth standing back and just thinking about two things, right? Question one is, what is society for? Why, you know, why are we here, right? Is it really to support the financial system and, you know, for financial stability, or is it about creating an environment where people want to live and work and grow and develop, right? At the moment, I think we're so myopic as to be scary. The second is that I think we need to expect the unexpected. So one of the things I've said to people is, you know, nobody knows how this is going to play out. There are too many variables, too many uncertainties. We don't even know whether the virus is going to get under control this year or next year and what the implications are there. So whatever you think might be the future ahead, I think it's also worth asking the question, what if you're wrong? What if the counterfactual actually plays out, and how are you prepared for that? Because I don't believe anybody can clearly predict the next 12 to 18 months.
Good place to leave it, Martin. I'll look forward to chatting. It'll probably only be maybe even a week or two until we get into that regular data series, guys. But we hope you have enjoyed that one. A look ahead, something a bit different. And as always, let us know what you want us to cover in the comments below. Links to Martin's channel down there. And yeah, thanks for joining us again, Martin.
Great talk. And we'll catch up in a week or so with some charts.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Cheers.